10. Payback time. Motherfuckers, it's payback time.
Every year of my life, that's almost 52 years so far, the world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we
Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This November 1st, 2016 edition, episode 99 of Nature Bats Last, comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico. Big thanks to Afrozen for his theme song contribution. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. This is Guy McPherson, and I'm going solo on today's show. Mike is hiking in the nearby wilderness, and I'm taking your toll-free calls at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. The nearby wilderness is the first designated wilderness in the world and also the largest wilderness area in the lower 48 states of the U.S. I'll start with a little history about that wilderness as I look out the window of the Mud Hut with a view that includes the riparian forest of the Gila River, the only remaining free-flowing river in the state of New Mexico. The Gila River has its headwaters in the Gila Wilderness, where Mike is hiking today. The Gila Wilderness, indeed the entire idea of protecting large areas and calling it wilderness, stems from the work of a forest ranger in the newly formed United States Forest Service. Aldo Leopold was his name. He was a naturalist and philosopher who wrote numerous essays and books about the natural world. The most famous of these, published a year after his death in 1948, is a collection of essays titled A Sand County Almanac. It's still required reading for most college students majoring in forestry and other natural resource fields. In 1909, Leopold's first year as a forest ranger for the recently created United States Forest Service, Leopold conducted a survey in the territories of Arizona and New Mexico. At that time, he documented six areas large enough for him to ride a horse for 2 weeks without encountering signs of civilization. These were areas larger than 500,000 acres, or about 200,000 hectares. A decade later, after both territories had become states, Leopold could only find one such location within the two states of Arizona and New Mexico. It was in the Gila Mountains, about which Leopold wrote widely. Upon documenting the demise of large untouched areas, Leopold immediately began his lifelong campaign to protect areas from civilization. As indicated in the United States Wilderness Act of 1964, these are areas where humans are visitors. Extraction of timber and ore are not allowed. We are transients who don't leave scars. It's quite a concept in a country founded on the notion of manifest destiny and hell-bent on civilizing the shit out of the natural world. When Leopold died in 1948 from fighting a grass fire on a neighbor's land, he had worked toward wilderness designation for 29 years. And a full 16 years after his death, the Gila Wilderness was declared the world's first. It's the size of Connecticut. To the east of the Gila Wilderness, across a narrow gravel road, lies the Aldo Leopold Wilderness Area. It's half the size of the Gila Wilderness, about the size of Rhode Island. Leopold's legacy lives on, and Mike is wisely taking advantage of it today. The Edge of Extinction episode posted at the blog last night focuses on Leopold and his pursuit of wilderness. This is a call-in show. Please give a toll-free shout at 888-874-4888. If you don't call, I'll keep telling mundane stories. You've been warned. I watched Leonardo DiCaprio's documentary film last night, Before the Flood. Apparently, he hasn't noticed the flood is already here. The film is basically an opportunity for DiCaprio to be seen hanging out with some people even better known than him, including the Pope and President Obama. It's a celebrity-based fix-it film focused on maintaining civilization while failing to recognize the costs of civilization. The film fails to mention that civilization is a heat engine, for example. It also fails to mention the 150 to 200 species driven to extinction every day. It also fails to mention the absence of global dimming attendant to the demise of civilization. Among the people DiCaprio interviewed on camera was Jason Box, climate scientist from Denmark. and that conversation took place in Greenland. Box pointed out Greenland's ice has melted to the tune of 30 feet in the last 5 years. 30 feet in 5 years. It's kind of a big deal. This is the same Jason Box who said he'd be interviewed on this very radio program if and only if I would admit my straw bale house is fixing climate change. The straw bale house has been here since 2008, and yet 30 feet of ice disappeared from Greenland since 2011. Apparently the straw bale house didn't fix climate change after all. If only it were so easy. Jason, we're extending the invitation yet again. In the absence of your calls, and they're welcome anytime within the next 50 minutes or so at 888-874-4888, I'll move on to a conversation with myself based on my recent essay at the blog. Titled A Letter to My Past, it generated quite a shitstorm of discussion after it was posted on GuyMcPherson.com on October 11th. You can still see it there. I'll read at least part of the letter, maybe the whole thing, and I'll read and comment on some of the subsequent online commentary. Dear ex-friends, colleagues, coworkers, family, and students, this letter attempts closure. Our incomplete relationship is comprised of ragged edges. I'd like to smooth some of the edges before we die. I know I'm not the same person I used to be. I killed the Buddha years ago. The Guy McPherson you claim to know disappeared long ago. To kill the Buddha is to destroy one's identity. The fully indoctrinated agent of imperialism who formerly promoted civilization became fully aware of the horrors of the normal set of living arrangements. The resulting personal changes were rapid and dramatic. Too many of the changes turned out badly. I'm going to stop right there and take a call from Karen in New Jersey. Karen, are you with me?
Yes, hello.
Yeah, what you got?
Let me ask you a question. I've heard analysis done with just carbon dioxide or carbon dioxide and methane, and I want to know if there's been a computer simulation done of all your 65-plus feedback loops that you found and the interactions between them?
Oh, that's a fine question, and I would love for you to contact every climate scientist you know, especially the modelers, to get them to conduct that analysis. I know of no such effort. I don't know that any single person has even considered that the six dozen and change self-reinforcing feedback loops exist, much less that they interact with each other. In fact, the only comment on those feedbacks with which I'm familiar came by email from Peter Wadhams. And in that email conversation, I was adding together the temperature-related implications associated with those self-reinforcing feedback loops. I was actually modifying and taking the most conservative route possible based on an analysis conducted by Sam Carana in mid-July of this year. And I added up a few of these self-reinforcing feedback loops and the temperature increase associated with them, and I came up with about 8.4 degrees Celsius above baseline within the next 10 years. And I was in this conversation with Peter Wadhams. He said, I'm not sure that's completely right. I'm not sure you should just add those things up. And I asked for clarification. He says, well, it might be a lot worse than that. They might actually be multiplicative. They might interact in such a way that they're not simply additive, but instead it's worse than that. You might have to multiply them together. Whoa! So Wadhams is one of the very, very few climate scientists, or even people who study climate change, who is willing to have a conversation with me. And he's certainly the only one who would admit that I'm being conservative in my approach. So great question. I really hope somebody will start putting together the information connecting the dots in a more formal manner than I have done with a modeling approach or some other approach. So thanks for the question, Karen. We now have Annie calling from Syracuse. Is that the Annie I know from Syracuse? And what do you got for me?
Oh, I just, I'm glad you saw the movie, the Before the Flood thing. I watched it as soon as I saw the notification somewhere, Reddit or Facebook or something. And Bill Nye, it's so interesting that these folks can see all the evidence and be so disheartened and so despairing, but then it's weird. It's like a conspiracy, I tell you. That at the end of the show, it's all going to be fine. If we just stop eating meat, if we really have a positive outlook, it's just amazing to me. It just stuns me. And I wanted to know your opinion on that.
I couldn't agree more. It's, you know, and it's, at some level it's pretty understandable because people like Bill Nye and Leonardo DiCaprio absolutely do not want this version of civilization to end. I mean, can you imagine people more privileged in this society than they are?
Mm-hmm.
Nye has a house on each coast, Southern California and New York City. I think DiCaprio is probably doing okay from a monetary perspective. So these folks are enjoying enormous privilege that comes with the inherent racism and the inherent misogyny and the inherent monetary disparity associated with every civilization. Why would they want it to go away? So they propose, well, first of all, they never mention the set of living arrangements. I suspect they fail to even recognize what a civilization is, including this one. And then if they do recognize it, they certainly don't want it to go away because they benefit so profoundly from it. So it's difficult from their perspective to connect the dots leading to our demise because along the way what that means is they have to give up some of their privilege. And you know, Leo is a fairly young man, at least from my perspective. I think he's 15 years younger than I am, born in 1975. So he's pretty much got his, quote, whole life ahead of him, except that I don't think that whole life is going to be very long, as you know. And so, of course, he doesn't want this show to end prematurely. Who can blame him? I don't want it to end prematurely either. Thanks for the call, Annie. I appreciate it. And we have Dave waiting from Pennsylvania. Dave, are you still with us?
Oh, hi. I'm here, and I watched the end of the flood last night, too, and I was going to follow up on the lady from Syracuse by saying that the film, and all these other ones, too, that talk about the environment and the impending predicament that we're facing, well, we don't have to change anything. None of us do. And I'm talking about society-wide, particularly in America. We're going to keep driving cars. We're going to keep doing everything we've been doing for the last 100 years, which really isn't very long, even though it is to us as individuals. But we're not going to have to change a thing. What will we do to change? And what's going to happen when it becomes so obvious that we have to change? What will people do?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, we keep promoting the same approaches, right? Squirrely light bulbs and eating lower on the food chain. And in the case of DiCaprio, one of the solutions he proposes is eating chicken instead of beef, because it doesn't take as much land to grow chicken as it does to grow a pound of beef or a similar amount of meat. So, I mean, these are not significant changes, folks. You know, switching from beef to chicken or even going vegan, or, I mean, we've just triggered so many self-reinforcing feedback loops at this point, and those sort of single-focused, quote, solutions like stop fracking and stop digging up the fossil fuels or reduce our reliance on fossil fuels or go solar and use wind power and eat lower on the food chain. Oh, none of that. It's too late for any of that. Had we actually stringently adopted those approaches, say, 50 or 100 years ago, then we'd be in a lot different place than we are now. But we didn't, and so we're not. And here we are instead in the midst of abrupt climate change, a whole other animal from anything humans have ever faced before, but a phenomenon with precedence in planetary history. So, yeah, I don't think you could convince Americans at this point, or maybe much of anybody in Western Europe, in the broader version of Western culture, to make the kinds of profound changes that would have been necessary a few decades ago. I don't think that's even possible. And to do them now is the classic example of too little, too late. So I just don't see this turning out well. And it certainly is not turning out well already for people who have been affected by climate change. So, it's, as I sometimes used to say before, people pointed out to me that I was kind of a bummer. It's going to get worse, and it's going to get worse. Tom, what do you got for us? We have another caller on the line. Tom, are you still with me? Tom from California. Seems we've
still
lost.
There?
Yeah, Tom, well, is that you?
Yeah, I'm still here. Yeah, it's me. I'm still here.
Great. What do you got?
I just wanted to say, well, you know, I've been listening to you for some time, and it's really refreshing for me. Just to briefly, years and years ago, my track was somewhat similar to yours in that I was just disgusted with what's going on. I took early retirement. And what happened is in my job as doing research, I discovered that the oil sands up in Canada were looking good because the Hudson Bay was going to become ice-free, and in fact, the North Pole was going to become ice-free, and that was great news because we're going to be able to build a harbor up there, and they're going to be able to ship the oil out. And I thought to myself, that's good news. So I started looking into things, and and I could tell as I thought it through. I mean, I have enough brains to figure out that this is really a serious problem. And hearing all this hopium, and you know, it's like all the sitcom shows or all the disaster shows you see in the movies where there's a problem, but at the end everything works out okay. And so we think that everything's going to be like that, and it's not. And so I was looking for some honesty, looking for some reality. And James Lovelock was the first one I found that was you know, saying it as he really, really saw it. And then I came on to you and I thought, wow, this is a guy who's just saying it exactly how he sees it. And that was, you know, very helpful for me to talk to what I consider to be a sane voice.
Well, thank you for that.
However, in the last several months, and you may agree with me, or maybe 6 months or so, I don't know if you're following geopolitical issues that are going on, and especially between Russia and the United States. I now, in the last several months, I'm thinking that, you know, maybe World War III will do us in before climate change does.
Oh, yeah, that wouldn't surprise me at all. I mean, I wrote an essay a month ago indicating that there are half a dozen paths to near-term human extinction, and we seem to be pursuing all of them quite rapidly. And among them is World War III, is the ionizing radiation associated with nuclear disaster, which can come in a couple of different ways. We can either have all the nuclear power plants in the world melt down, or we can bomb ourselves into oblivion. So, you know, at this point, very little would surprise me. I was interviewed a couple of years ago by a guy in New Zealand, and I said something like, I say every day that nothing could possibly surprise me anymore. And then by noon the following day, I'm going, really? So I say nothing can surprise me, including World War III, and I think that we're in it right now. by various proxy forms, and I don't see it getting better no matter what happens in the election next week. So, yeah, it's there are many ways that we can continue to foul our nest. Ionizing radiation from nuclear catastrophe, from nuclear bombing ourselves into oblivion is one of those ways. Wouldn't surprise me if we took that route. Wouldn't surprise me at all. And surely the people who are pulling the strings of empire know about abrupt climate change and might think at this point, well, what the hell? We're all dead soon anyway, so we might as well pull this lever. That's where insanity goes, folks. Bob in Toronto. Bob, you with me? What do you got? Bob from Toronto. Are you still with me? Hey, Bob.
Yeah. Hey, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Just three things. One, I wanted to say how much happiness you brought me by deciding to scale back a little bit. That was a great note when that came out. I was like, that's good. He's totally earned it. I really appreciated that. Two, I've written a trilogy of poems called On the End of the World, At the End of the World, and I think you really enjoy it, and I'd love to get a comment from you on that. And then three, you know, that last caller about the advent of nuclear war, it does seem like it would be in America's best interest, don't you think, to start a nuclear war right now, as soon as possible, don't you think?
You know, I'm no fan of abrupt climate change. I'm no fan of nuclear war. I'm no fan of killing ourselves by any potential possible route.
Yep.
So would it be in America's best interest to further World War III? Maybe, if you're into that sort of power by force.
Yeah, because they have this whole belief that American lives are worth more than other lives. That's sort of the guiding principle of empire, right? So for them, they're going to think to themselves, well, if we knock out all these cities and reduce the world population by 4 or 5 billion, then there's a better chance for each American life.
Right. Well, yes, I certainly agree with that. And I fear and suspect that a lot of Americans agree with that, too. And
mm-hmm.
here I'm using the common term American to specifically refer to people in the United States instead
right.
of all of the Americas. So I get that being terribly nationalistic. But yes, I suspect a lot of people in the United States would rather have what's left of everything reserved for us than have some commie from Russia using up any of the oil or using up any of the ore we might put into solar panels or so on. So, yeah, I mean, this is where American exceptionalism goes. We actually have come to believe that we're exceptional, that we are more important not only than every other species on the planet, but than every other culture, and in the case of people from the United States, more important than people from any other country on the planet. So, I've been fed this stuff my whole life. It doesn't surprise me when this comes up, and it comes up all the time. It seems to me it's sometimes cloaked better than other times. I mean, hardly ever anymore does a president come out and say, you know, we're going to bomb the Russians because we hate them. It's been a while since there was an axis of evil identified, even Iran, right? So typically the language is a little bit more subtle, but you don't have to read very far between the lines to figure out what's going on, to figure out that, in fact, this idea of American exceptionalism and the idea of civilization, of keeping the trucks running at any cost, is part and parcel of how we got here and how we're going to continue to stretch this thing out for as long as humanly possible. I think that's coming into play with the mainstream media reporting about this forthcoming election. It's all about maintaining this set of living arrangements at all and every cost. Now, Bob, you're welcome to send me your poetry. I'd love to see that. So send me an email message. All my contact information is at guymcpherson.com. Send me an email message, and I'll write back, and we'll figure out how we can make that happen. I look forward to reading your poetry. We have Gayo from Arkansas. Gayo, you still with me?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, fire away, buddy.
How are you?
I've been worse. How about yourself? How's Arkansas treating you?
Oh, it's good here. It's warm. That's, well, I'm wondering, you know, this rapid runaway that is possible, do you think maybe we're already in that, you know, several years into it already?
I think we're already in it. I think that we are already in the midst of abrupt climate change. We're in the early stages of abrupt climate change, but I think we're there. I think that it is irreversible at this point, and we keep seeing things pop up that are truly unprecedented. I could get into some of the headlines that I was going to read towards the end of the show, but they're things like this from the New York Times: living in China's expanding deserts, we dread the sandstorms. From the Associated Press: at ground zero of Alabama's drought, it's an agricultural disaster. And the hits keep coming. You know, this is from Bloomberg yesterday. Long the talk of conspiracy theorists, geoengineering schemes move closer to reality. United Nations body is investigating controversial methods to avert runaway climate change by giving humans the go-ahead to re-engineer the Earth's oceans and atmosphere. Well, the National Academy of Sciences of the United States and an equivalent body in Europe within the last 2 years have both concluded that geoengineering is likely to make things worse, not better. But we're desperate. And so this is another headline from Bloomberg, again, just yesterday: climate change is already forcing Americans to move. That's from Bloomberg. This is not some extreme liberal left-wing source. We're talking about Bloomberg here admitting that Americans are being forced to move because of climate change, that we have climate change refugees, and they're not just in the Middle East, and they're not just in Northern Africa, and they're not just in the Southern Pacific and island states that are being overwhelmed by storm surges. They're happening here, even in the land of American exceptionalism, where only exceptional people live. Here, people are being forced to move as a result of climate change. So, yeah, I strongly suspect we're in the early stages of abrupt climate change, and that habitat for humans will end everywhere on the planet in the not-too-distant future. And that's what makes me such an unpopular guy all around the world. Thanks for your call, Gayo.
Well, I just heard that, you know, if it happens, you know, it can happen rapidly, 10, 15, 20 years, then maybe we're already 10 years into the 20-year decline.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me at all. I think that the tipping point on the class rate gun, I think that was fired in 2007. That's methane leaking out of the Arctic Ocean at an accelerating rate. It appears to me that happened in 2007. People tell me all the time, no, you can't really tell that happened. You can't tell that the class rate gun was fired for 10 years afterward. We need 10 years worth of data. Well, okay, we're at 9. And I'm willing to stick my neck out and say that we are experiencing atmospheric methane going exponential in the atmosphere. And, of course, that makes me the crazy man in scientific circles because I'm willing to stick my head out to such a great degree. But, yes, I agree that these tipping points have been crossed already, some of them quite a while ago, and so the time to make significant changes in the way we live is long behind us. And let me make a correction, by the way, pointed out to me by a friend on Facebook. A lot of vegans, including her, do not believe that veganism will save us. They believe instead that veganism will make for less suffering for non-human organisms. So that's a good point. Not all vegans I talk to say that veganism will save habitat for ourselves, will allow us to persist a little bit longer on the planet. So That's a good point. I stand corrected. So sorry about that, Amy. And correction noted. We have another caller. This one is Brett from Los Angeles, unless LA stands for Lower Asphaltistan. Brett, are you still with me?
I am. I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. What do you got?
Well, you know, it's like I've been paying attention ever since the Fukushima disaster started. And I come from a medical background, and I know that, you know, it basically has shaved at least 20 years off of everybody's life. That's the way I look at it, because it's out of control, and nobody wants to talk about it, just like nobody wants to talk about methane or any of the other climate issues. But, you know, it's very hard to wake up in the morning and face this. And I just know that for myself, I have become increasingly isolated because of it. And I feel like, you know, my little catchphrase is that the world is in hospice. Because I feel like that's where we are. And there's a great opportunity to die consciously, live consciously, die consciously at this point, because I don't know that there's any solution. I mean, I think we all keep talking about a solution, and it's like, Fukushima, there's really no solution. I don't see, you know, on the horizon, I don't see any possibility for hope. It's very hard to get through each day without terrible distractions to try to come up with something to smile about. And, you know, rather than get caught in that, I just don't know where to go to get some sense of community where we can, like, go evolve to the next level through our death. I don't know what else to say about this. It's very difficult to talk about.
Yeah, that's an excellent series of points you've made there. This is a very difficult subject to talk about. We're talking about arguably the most important phenomenon in the history of our species on planet Earth. The extinction of our favorite species, of the most sentient of species we're aware of, the most self-aware, the most intelligent, at least by our measure of intelligence, although there's considerable question about how intelligent we really are given what we've done to ourselves and to others. So, yeah, this is hard. There's no question about that. I have a dear friend, Paul Marcotte, who is a Canadian, and he, it took, you know, like with most people, it took him a while to come to grips with the fact that we are in hospice, that we are going extinct, and so are so many other organisms at the hand of industrial civilization. And that's tough to deal with because we like it here. And so for Paul constantly reminds me pretty much every time I talk to him now, which we have a weekly telephone call, and he points out to me that if it weren't for you, he says, talking about me, if it weren't for you, I wouldn't have known what a miracle it is that I'm here, that the odds, based on our knowledge of DNA, the odds of us being here are truly cosmological. And yet here we are in physical form against all those odds, against, as Richard Dawkins says, in the teeth of these stupefying odds, it is you and I that are privileged to be here, privileged with eyes to see where we are and brains to wonder why. So it is amazing. Yes, it's the most dire time we could possibly imagine. People are dying in droves as a result of climate change, as a result of imperialism run amok, as a result of every imaginable disease created and spread by industrial civilization. And the list just goes on and on and on. You can get mired in despair as a result of that. Your own personal situation might be truly horrible. You might have essentially nobody you can talk to. And that there's no doubt in my mind that that makes it incredibly difficult to get through the day. This is the point of the essay I wrote from the blog, A Letter to My Past. I posted it October 11th, and I pointed out how difficult it was when I have lost my friends, my colleagues, my coworkers, my family, and my students, the people who were important to me in my life. I lost them all as a result of this message I was promulgating. And it's a difficult road. But on the other hand, we get to live. We get to be here against odds that are truly cosmological. So let's act as if those moments we help create actually matter. They matter to us. They matter to the people around us. So let's take a relatively compassionate approach no matter how long we have left. You know, we were never guaranteed another day. We were never guaranteed another hour. I could croak by the time this radio show is over, and I'm sure a lot of people would greatly appreciate that. And certainly I could croak the next time I get on a plane or not, or the next time I'm driving down the road. I mean, none of us are guaranteed any additional existence in the world. So let's be fully present with where we are, with what we're experiencing, and with the people we're with. That's really my whole message. My whole message is pursue excellence, pursue love in your life, and those two alone will make you stand out like the proverbial sore thumb, because you won't be on the hamster wheel that is industrial civilization. So, and then let go. Recognize that we can let go or be dragged. Recognize that we should remain calm because nothing is under control, and from our individual perspectives, it was never under control. So there are things we can do. There are behaviors we can take that will make the situation better for us and better for the people around us, not to mention the rest of the living planet. So I guess what I'm trying to promote is to do those things that enrich the lives of the non-human species and also the other human beings in our midst. It's a tough sell in a must-go-faster culture, but I don't think it's a bad sell no matter how long we have left on the planet. Thanks very much, Brett. I appreciate your call. And I think we have David from Wyoming, if we haven't put you on hold for too terribly long. David from Wyoming, are you still with me?
I am. I don't know. I just turned into the program, and I thought someone was referring to the National Geographic special that came out about the flood.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And it sounds like you've got all kinds of topics. I kind of like to address my experience with the global warming. I learned about it in college when I was a sophomore in 1964 at the University of Arizona, and two years later I bought a vehicle that got 55 miles to the gallon, and of course those were all stopped from being imported. Loved it too. I loved that little car. And I don't know. I listened to a program recently through the PRN programming, and it was from a very knowledgeable scientist, I thought, that said we have already gone over the tipping point of no return. And there's really this idea of man-made mitigation is, he said, it's just a joke. We don't have the technologies to do that. The rise of the oceans, for several years, I thought to myself, well, we need to have all the ice melt in order for the oceans not to die. And, of course, that's going to raise the water level, I think it was something like 30 meters, and 80% of the population live on the ocean. Every major city is on the ocean. However, that's the way I see it happening. He's already said the civilization is going to disappear. And, you know, it's if you can see what's going on now anyway, even disregarding the global warming, I mean, you can understand why civilizations have disappeared in the past. There's only one place that I read recently or heard recently that the Chinese are putting together a $50 trillion investment worldwide to rapidly eliminate fossil fuels for energy. Have you heard about that one?
No, I have not.
Yeah, which makes sense, you know, because even though, you know, whether it rains at a given location often depends on whether someone is drinking a glass of water on their lawn outside. That's just how complex weather really is. So we don't really know for certain how it's going to go, but we're pretty certain that we really underestimated how rapidly it's changing. I know it seems like about 12 years ago they said there'd be summer ice in the Arctic until the end of this century, and now they're saying there may be no summer ice next summer. So that's going to cause a tremendous increase in the ocean temperatures.
No, you're absolutely right. Let me address some of the points you brought up, if you don't mind. And you brought up some excellent points. Congratulations on your car decision in 1964. I'd say you were well ahead of the curve on that one. With respect to the Chinese and their pouring money into solar, we have to keep in mind that civilization itself is a heat engine. We've known this for a while. Tim Garrett wrote the signature paper on the topic in 2007. It was published online in 2009. It drew such an outcry from the scientific community, mostly from the university academic community, that the paper was pulled from publication until two research groups had an opportunity to respond to it. And then it was published finally, in final form, in February 2011. Now, Garrett was not allowed to respond to those two commentary papers focused on criticizing his initial work. So, you know, civilization is a heat engine. To my knowledge, nobody has pointed out in any way that civilization is not a heat engine. Of course, people are trying to maintain civilization because it's what we know. People benefit from it to a great extent, particularly people in, for example, the privileged global north. But that fails to recognize that people who are trying so hard to prop up civilization by any means necessary, including apparently world war, don't recognize that civilization itself is a heat engine. So thanks for your comments. Thanks for your commentary. Thanks for your questions. I'm going to move on now and take a question from Kevin in New Zealand. I would imagine that's my sailor friend. Kevin, what do you got?
Hi, Guy. Greetings from a very warm morning on Rakino Island in the Hauraki Gulf of New Zealand.
Thank you.
There's two points that I'd like to bring up. Earlier, you guys discussed the possibility of a nuclear war and the implications. I've got a blog post on my website, kevinhester.live, called The Inevitability of Nuclear War and Subsequent Nuclear Winter. And it's based a lot on the research by Carl Sagan about the possibility of a nuclear winter resulting from a nuclear weapons exchange between India and Pakistan. The point I'd like to make on that is that the only thing now that will in any way slow down runaway abrupt climate change, which I believe we're already in, is a nuclear winter. And the psychopaths that control the United States, I can't see in any way, shape, or form that they won't go for the last tool that they've got and use that option. So that, in conjunction with the story about the new Leonardo DiCaprio movie, where they keep talking about sea level rise, and personally, I believe that habitat is going to collapse so quickly that humans probably won't get to see a meter of sea level rise, and it's the whole sea level rise issue is sort of a way to control the narrative and to keep us thinking about what's going to happen in 2100, way, way off in the future, when this situation is bearing down on us right now. is an interesting development in New Zealand happening with regards to the U.S. military machine, the Pentagon, and the most destructive military in the history of humankind, is that 32 years ago, we managed to stop nuclear ships and nuclear-powered and armed ships from coming to New Zealand. And John Key, the New Zealand Prime Minister, who used to be a Wall Street banker, has just allowed American warships to come back to New Zealand. And we're going to be having demonstrations in the next few weeks to see if we can yet again stop that lunacy happening. I'd just like to draw attention to the latest post from Dar Jamal, where he's talking about how depleted uranium munitions that have been used off the coast of the United States are now poisoning your water as they break down in the ocean. That same military is on its way to New Zealand, and I think that the bringing back of the ships to New Zealand is just the thin end of the wedge of New Zealand becoming the 51st state and U.S. military bases being built in New Zealand. You better get here quick, brother, for your New Zealand tour, because things are unraveling pretty quickly.
Yeah, thanks for calling in, Kevin. I appreciate it. You're dead on with every point, of course. I encourage people to go to kevinhefter.live for Kevin's informed analysis of nuclear war and many other facets resulting from this version of civilization. Kevin will be hosting me in New Zealand for a speaking tour beginning in a little less than 3 weeks. So if you're in New Zealand listening today, I look forward to interacting with you on the road. If you're not in New Zealand, be sure to tell your New Zealand friends to take cover. Guy McPherson is coming to town. Thanks for the call. And I think we're all caught up on the calls at this point. So I'm going to go rambling back to whatever topic I was on quite a long time ago. One thing I did mention was some evidence of abrupt climate change. I'm going to read some headlines and give some sources additional to the ones I gave when I was speaking with Gaio from Arkansas. All of these have appeared within the last week. I listed four headlines already from within the last week. These are further ones. Headline from the Science Explorer: researchers say efforts to curb climate change will likely fail. Yes, apparently we're past the point of no return, folks. According to Carbon Brief, a very conservative source, climate change could push risk of mega drought to 99% in American Southwest. I think that's being conservative, but what do I know? 99, maybe that's good enough for everybody else. Then we think we're going to be the ones who escape, right? Everybody else is going to die, but not me. New York Times poses the question by a headline, "Where should you live to escape climate change?" Well, if you live in the Middle East or Northern Africa, if you live on one of the small island states in the South Pacific, if you live in many places in the United States, it's a little late to escape climate change. You've already tried to run away. I promise that in the very near future, nobody will escape abrupt climate change. Notice that word doesn't appear very often, abrupt, in headlines in the mainstream outlets. Also within the last week, this from Bloomberg, I've quoted a couple of their headlines already. This, again, is a business-based publication, Bloomberg.com. Here's the headline, "Magical thinking won't stop climate change." Oh, magical thinking won't stop climate change. Well, that's kind of a bummer, because I thought that's all we had at this point was magical thinking. Now you're telling me that won't even work. So according to Inside Climate News, rapidly warming Mediterranean is headed for desertification, according to a recent study. Also from Inside Climate News, warming triggers early algae blooms with potential ripple effects to come. Yeah. Mm-hmm. According to Scientific American, here's the headline, "Dreaded polar vortex may be shifting." And I've come to believe that anytime there's a maybe or a would or a could in the headline, what it really means is it's already happening. So all this stuff is already underway. We just don't want to admit it to ourselves. And sparing you from me reading further headlines, which, of course, you could read yourself all day on the Internet, I have Grant calling from Chicago. Grant, thanks for your patience. What do you got?
Oh, yeah, just making sure I was far enough away from the radio so there's no echo. Anyway, I've seen you talk a couple of times, and as you like to end it, only love remains. And just pretty much that, you know, where you can't control the government or you know, World War III or who's going to be elected, you can't control yourself. And, you know, I think I've always just enjoyed trying to be friendlier to other people, have more patience, and take it from there.
Yeah, you have heard me speak a couple of times. I met you in Chicago, Grant. I won't reveal your last name on the phone, even though, believe it or not, I remember it. These days I can hardly remember my own. So thanks for the call. I very much appreciate you reinforcing my message that in the end, we don't have much control over anything except for the relatively few people we encounter on a regular basis in our lives. And typically that's family and friends and maybe coworkers, that sort of thing. And so we do have control over the way those people feel. Let's not be assholes. I mean, let's be nice to them. Let's be kind. Let's be compassionate with those we're with. Let's show a little respect. You know, all those kinds of things that we say are important and we claim are the values we hold. But then when you're having a hard day and something goes wrong at the end of the day, we all have this tendency to lash out a little bit. And so I appreciate you calling in, Grant, and reminding us that at the edge of extinction, only love remains. And we're there. We are at the edge of extinction. And so let's go down with love. Let's go down demonstrating the kinds of values in our behavior that we claim to hold dear. We're going down, folks. How are we going to act on the way? Are we going to demonstrate the best of humanity, or are we going to demonstrate the worst of humanity on our way out the door? Let's not leave the movie early. Let's hang in for the whole show. And in addition, let's act like the best human beings we can be to other human beings and to the rest of the living planet as well. I'm going to move on and talk about a climate change update that is from way back in July for the August show we didn't do. And then in the subsequent show, I didn't actually manage to bring it up because it seems like we're always running out of time. But I love this one because I think I'm so clever. And so I'm going to share this one with you because nobody is on the line right now, so you're stuck with me. We've long believed the extinction of dinosaurs about 66 million years ago was driven by an asteroid striking the Yucatan Peninsula. A paper in the July 14, 2016 issue of Scientific Reports adds to the story. Turns out the asteroid struck an oil-rich area, and the attendant release of soot from burning oil caused the skies to darken and therefore create sufficient cooling that the dinosaurs were unable to survive. It wasn't just the asteroid. It wasn't just the asteroid kicking up a bunch of dust. It was the asteroid lighting an oil-rich area, sparking it and causing the burning oil to release soot that caused the skies to darken. That caused the extinction. The asteroid striking oil caused the extinction of the dominant life form on the planet. In not so sharp contrast, we struck oil and triggered a massive warming event leading to human extinction. We are the asteroid that struck the oil. We are the dinosaurs that died as a result. We're really that good. That wraps up this week's show. Be sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bath Blast and the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bath Blast on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show, and please share widely the link and information from this show. Also continue to follow my blog, GuyMcPherson.com, for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. Mike and I will see you on the radio the first Tuesday afternoon of each month at 3 p.m. Eastern. That means our next show, which has us breaking triple digits in number of episodes, we'll broadcast live on Tuesday afternoon, the 6th of December. I'll be calling in from the home of Kevin Hester in New Zealand, where it'll be 8 o'clock in the morning on the 7th of December. For a change, I'll be ahead of most of my listeners. I'll be on tour thanks to the generosity of Kevin, and you, if you're willing and able to support the effort. Details about that can be found near the bottom of each recent post at the blog. If you miss us live, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM or at Stitcher, and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to our listeners and Aphrodite for his music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, nature bats last.
Mother Nature.